And we're going to continue to turn back the clock and go much further to the real roots of what we do. And I'm happy that George Bruck-Nonstadt has come here to share this with us. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That's just for the effort of coming here. Now, the title is using a word that not everybody is using daily. It's epistemology. And so I went out and bought the academic outline in philosophy to find out what it meant. And it says here it's theories of knowledge. And I think that's as deep as we are going to go into that word. And we'll get on with what the actual matter is. Now, first of all, the reason that we need to discuss the knowledge and the structure of the knowledge in our field is, for instance, this particular phenomenon. Phonography, or writing by sound, being also a new and natural system of shorthand. Now, yes, and this is Isaac Pitman, later Sir Isaac Pitman, who became a great publisher. He invented that in 1837, and all through that century, phonography was shorthand, and that is not at all what we are dealing with. So that is why we need to get on with what we are dealing with, which is recording of sound, to some degree transmission of sound from one place to the other. We have various statements that people might subscribe to. For instance, I have a list here. Now, Edison invented sound recording. That's what people believe. Edison invented sound reproduction. That's what some people believe. Edison was the first to demonstrate sound reproduction. I'm fairly certain that I can convince that the second is the correct one in this circle. We know that Edison wasn't the first to record, but certainly we know he was the first to reproduce. But what about this demonstrate in the third statement? Well, that is because there was somebody before him who who had the idea that you could reproduce sound. So according to the French, it was Charles Cros, and he was earlier. He was in April of 77, whereas Edison only demonstrated that in, let's say, July. Some say August. I tend to believe July. That was the reduction to practice, which is a US standard. One of the things you have to fulfill in order to have made a patentable invention is that you must have had conception and you must have had reduction to practice. And definitely that is what Edison did. But then we have the fourth statement. Edison was the first to demonstrate reproduction of a recording of a sound. Now, that is even more correct, because sound reproduction depends entirely on what you think you have recorded. If you have had a music box, that is a sort of recording. It is not a recording of a live performance. It is much closer to what was the idea of the composer. It is probably close to the music the composer wrote, but there might be things, embellishments written into it, which it was a skill rather than something that was made into the in the music that was put onto the music box. So actually, the fourth one is more correct than the third one. Then we have Edison was the first to demonstrate reproduction of a recording of a sound received via the air. Now that implies that there is a receiver for sound that has to convert that into something that can be recorded and later, as he demonstrated, be reproduced. And you can very well imagine other things being recorded by direct transmission, and that has been done. Then there is the last statement, the longest one. Edison was the first to demonstrate reproduction of a recording of a sound received via the air and to use a reproducing element which was not merely the reciprocal use of the recording element. That's a lot of words, but what it means is he had a separate recording device and a separate replay device. Now, the first experiments did not have that. He used the same stylus for recording and for reproduction, but on the later ones, he had a second set of stylus and diaphragm and used that for reproduction. And that, of course, is absolutely also true. He was the first to do that. But we have used words like playable. Now, what is playable? That has been used in discussion. What do we like best? Do we say we want to be very, I would say, narrow-minded, because it reduces our possibilities of electing something to fit into that category? Playable was playable at the time of its recording. Or else is playable now with improved recording technology. Now, this is a very important distinction, because since 1857, we had recordings that were not playable. We'll have to look, what is a recording then, all right? Recording may be directly replayable subsequent, may be directly replayable subsequent to its recording. It may be transformed at the time of its recording into something playable then, and since we still have the recording, again now, unless it's deteriorated, of course. But we are not considering that issue at all. We're looking at the fundamental matters here, from sound and into the ear, or from generator to the ear, some way it comes from that end to the other end. Or else we can have transformed now into something playable now. The funny thing is that that directly replayable subsequent to recording, that was definitely Edison, transformed at the time of recording into something playable then and again now, that would be something like what Charles Cross thought about and which Berliner reduced to practice in 1887. Their process was a very particular one. The transformed now into something playable now would be to take some of the graphical tracings that had been made since the discovery or the invention of the phonautograph in 1857 and convert that into something that can be heard today. I've done some experiments in that. The tracing can be transformed into a WAV file, and then the WAV file can be transformed into sound by putting through a sound card and giving it a proper clock frequency. It's very muddled, I can tell you. It doesn't sound of very much, but it is still a tracing different from other tracings, and so you can distinguish between them, but what it is you are really distinguishing is very difficult to say. Now we come to the most important slide of the presentation. Because we are the ones to fill the boxes. And the simplest, and that's why I don't even want to bother to write on it, is to say, okay, here at the top, we have the sound generation, here we have the air, and here we have the ear. That's live music, straight, close to the performer. If we're a bit more sophisticated, we say, all right, here we have the concept of the sound. Here we have the sound as performed. This would comprise all instructions to the instrument. That is, that would be the written music in some cases. It would be the skill of the performer, and so on. Here we have the sound. Here we have the air, here we have the ear. But that's not really very interesting. It doesn't tell us much of what is really going on. We have to look at how far can we stretch this. There's no doubt that sitting close to a performer, that's a simple model and it works. It doesn't help us with sound recording. It doesn't help us with what happens at greater distances. So I've filled in some of the schematic here. Right. Here we have the idea. We have it's made into sound. We have the air. And now comes a diaphragm. Do we need a diaphragm? Yes and no. If we want to listen to something at a distance, we can just move further back. Eventually, the sound becomes so faint that you can't hear it. So what can we do? We can enclose the sound in a tube, what I call a sound conduit. We could take a hose, a tube you call it, straight to the instrument and remove it like a speaking tube on board a ship or something, back to where you are sitting, and you could put your ear against it and you could hear what is going on, not disturbed by extraneous noises. And there will be distortions, certain strange distortions by listening through a tube, but you would still hear it. It's used in stethoscopes. It was used in the early phonographs, but there you had a diaphragm in between. All right, we need the diaphragm anytime we want to transport sound at longer distances. The simplest thing is to have a diaphragm, a taut string, and another diaphragm. And then when you talk, lots of people, lots of children in particular have tried this, but those children will have grown up and have become you. People will have tried it, speaking at the end of a tin can, have a string between that and the bottom of another tin can, and that's a so-called string telephone. Now, there you have, apart from elasticity and things like that, you have a synchronous movement between the two diaphragms. So you have a receiving diaphragm, you have transport of the sound signal, and you have a transmitting diaphragm at the other end, and then you have your ear. And this is what goes into, for instance, electrical recording. We have idea, sound, air, a diaphragm, a transducer. Now, that's a transducer which transfers the energy from being a movement of the diaphragm driven by sound pressure variations in the air into, for instance, an electrical current. It could be the intensity of a light beam. The Volta Laboratory got their prize for having developed the photophone, that is, the modulation of light intensity. They did it in a very simple fashion by means of mirrors, but I mean, it was conversion of a vibration created by sound pressure variations into a modulation of a different form of energy, namely a beam of light. And that was then received at the other end by something that had been developed ready to use for this kind of purpose, a light-sensitive material. I believe it was selenium, actually, but they had already found out that that was sensitive to light intensity, and you got an electric current, and you could then hear the sound at the other end. So you have in this case, we don't discuss the photophone, we just say, all right, transducer, that's microphone, into electrical current, and a transducer, again, back to a diaphragm, to air, and to the ear. So we have a long change of things. And the choice of phenomenon, physical phenomenon that we want to rely on, is fairly wide. The most usually used one is the electrical current, because it's practical and we know how to handle it. The light beam has also been used. That was mainly to evade a patent in early electrical recording. And the important other thing is that it also allows us to introduce the concept of amplification. Because every time we move from one domain to the other, we have a loss of signal. It gets reduced, and you have to amplify it. I'll see if we can find some good amplifiers for us. Now we are getting very technical, but actually amplification is essential, and I'll get back to why even acoustic recording was amplified. Some of you will have read C.V. Boy's book, Water, the Soap Bubbles and the Forces Which Mold Them. Some boys can't resist that sort of book, and they will have read them. That is a question of letting water drops drop through a nozzle that's vibrated, and that interrupts a flow of water, typically, that flows through the nozzle, and when that hits a drum skin below, the sound is amplified and radiated in an amplified fashion from the drum skin. That's a sort of amplifier where he uses the gravity to amplify. Higham, who was very intimately connected to Columbia, and I think also Edison in his kinetophone work, made a friction amplifier that worked directly off the reproducing stylus. Then there was Parsons with his oxetophone, that he had a system, a valve that was controlled by the vibrations and let through varying amount of compressed air. So that would have had a background hiss at all times, because you have always, when you have something that is working unilaterally, if you want to reproduce sound, you have to give it an output that is something when there's no signal, so that there is less when there's a negative going signal, and there is more when there's a positive going signal. That was then displacement into velocity of air. Jonsson Rabeck, that's a Danish invention, but it was internationally recognized at the time. That's a friction electrostatic device. You had a cylinder turning and a belt around it, and when you applied a voltage across them, a modulating voltage, the attraction was varying, so that precisely as in the Higham, you would then have a pull that was much stronger, controlled by the rotating cylinder. Then there is, of course, in telephone technology, which is very important because that is where Edison came from, telegraph technology, wire telegraph technology. Relays, that is an amplifier. It has a small current and it controls a large current, but that is on-off. Then there is the amplifying tube, which with a voltage controls a current, and we have the transistor, which is generally recognized in the early days anyway, as being a small current to a large current amplifier. So those are the forms of amplification. And as you see, they are not all electrical. They are certainly, some of them are mechanical. And that means that in the long chain that we had here, they are transparent, you can't see them very well. You have a choice of where you want to put your amplification. So, for instance, you would say, well, the Parsons would be here, and the Higham, the electrical ones would be here. If you go really into electrical recording, electrical transmission, you have to put in amplification at various stages here and here. Now, here it says electrical current. What if we use that to modulate a radio transmitter? When we have radio waves representing the original sound being the practical performance of the idea. And yes, of course. So what we have created here is a transmission of the sound from one place to the other, and we could call it a live transmission. We hear it almost at the same time as it was produced. But we have a lot of elements that we already recognize now, all the transducers, all the amplifiers. If we say, okay, I mean, this is sound that we are listening to, what about a music box? Well, the music box would then go into here and would be the idea. The instructions would be in the form of little metal pegs in the cylindrical surface of the music box. Same thing with a player piano. The instruction for the sound generator would come in here. If we look at synthesized music or electronic music, that is something that never existed as a sound. It gets injected at this place by the electric current. So we have an electrical input here that we make go through transducer, diaphragm, that's a loudspeaker in this case, through the air to the ear. So we in no way can we avoid these things if we want to delay the sound or take it now, keep it, that is, store it, and replay it later. How does that fit into this chain of events? Right. Actually, I've just taken the middle part of it, and the top and the bottom are gone. We have the diaphragm, we have a transducer. We have, that is supposed to say amplifier. We have a current, electrical current, and we have amplification. Then we have a second transducer, that is the cutter head. Then we have the storage medium. When on replay, we have to have a transducer again, that is going from medium to electrical current, that is the pickup. We have an amplifier, we have a transducer, that is now our loudspeaker with a diaphragm, and it goes to our ears. So there's a lot of reuse in this, and you could say that any kind of remote listening is very, very similar to listening to a recording. Only we have opened the chain of the direct listening and put in elements which are specific to recording. Right, I'll just see how far we went, whether we have lost any of the important things here. So actually the chain that we saw was broken in two places, in between that current, which used to be the same as that current, and we have put in the part of chain which is required, which are the requirements of the recording system. That's very important, the recording system. Some of the developers of recording considered it a system, and others did not. Edison was definitely a systems man when he took up development of recording again, when he developed his Blue Amberol and the Diamond Disc. He was very much into the system, and he used parts further on in the chain to compensate for problems that were early in the chain, and he was one of the first to do it in the acoustic period, whereas a company like Victor or the Gramophone Company, they saw their records being used on more general equipment. They should sound reasonably well on all kinds of gramophones, so they didn't have the systems thought as such. But Edison did, and that put a great strain on, and he had a great need for instance, noiseless material, which of course suffered during the First World War, where you couldn't get the proper resins for his process. Now, the thing we have to think about is that Edison came from the telegraph field and into the telephone field. And his approach to sound recording did not come out of the idea that recording as such existed and he needed a way to reproduce it. He was already then thinking in system, namely the telephone system. He wanted to record a telephone conversation and to be able to play it back. And his approach was based on his technology. His technology was one of the telegraph receiver, telegraph transmitter. The telegraph receiver was a relay in which the armature would go up and down and it would make pen markings usually. But he found out that he could make actually impressions in a surface which for lubricating strengthening purposes, he impregnated with a wax material. And he made the observation when he did that he could also pull it past a point and hear something that made a noise which could be similar to whispering or sounds of people in the background. And that is the way he worked. And if you look at his patents and his notebooks, which are now available on Rutgers, a lot of the correspondence and so on is available on the Rutgers University website. You will see that he was basically applying the things that he had already to hand for his work. So he did not conceive it as sound recordings we have, how do we reproduce them? That is what Charles Cort did. He took out the outset from what was done by Scott's phonautograph, which was made by a Paris instrument maker, and realized that you could make photo engraving of the curved tracings. And he thought that you could then make a stylus. It could etch by means of the photo engraving. You got a groove, and you could then follow the groove by means of a little stylus that would then make a vibration similar to the vibration of the phonautograph. He was an impractical man. He made also inventions in color photography, but he was basically an artist, and he had no laboratory facilities. So he just deposited this as his great idea with the Academy of Sciences. So in mechanical recording, we have two kinds of modulation. We have to realize that there is the vertical one, which is the one that Edison used because it was natural to him in his stage of development, the up-down movement of the armature of the receiving relay. And there was the lateral one, which came from Leon Scott, the phonautograph, and which was Charles Cros and Berliner's idea. If you read his first patent, 1887, you will realize that he made a photo engraving. He first had a sound recording, which was a tracing in a black surface, and he was able to throw light through that and photo engrave a record below that. Only later on did he develop scratching in wax, not recording in wax, as it was said on the video we saw, but scratching in wax and bearing a metal surface that could then be directly etched and obtain the lateral grooves that way. Lateral modulation has had a continuous life, well, from 1887 and to these days, or I have in the written form, I'm saying 1983, because that's when the CD came. Whereas vertical modulation only lived till about 1940, something like that, because it was very much used in radio transcription. There are transcriptions from later than that, but it really, most of it stopped in around 1940. And then it came back again in 1957 in the form of the stereo record. Half of stereo record is basically vertical modulation, although the modulation is not obtained like that. Basically, you could even say that stereo recording are two vertical modulations at right angles to each other, the left channel and the right channel. They are both vertical modulations. And they combine then to make the horizontal mono, and if you switch one of the coils, the vertical mono. So from 1957 with the stereo record, at least being very commercial, is the second starting date for vertical modulation. Now, whenever you record in a soft material and you then convert the grooves in the soft material into grooves in a harder material, and you replay it afterwards, even on the same machine that recorded it, you have amplification. That is because the soft material has one impedance and the movement, and the hard material has another impedance, and going from soft to hard is actually a power amplification. So you even an acoustic record where the grooves came from wax, went into metal, and then back to not shellac. It's not a shellac record, it's a rotten stone record, because it's made out, it's like concrete. There's very little cement in concrete, the rest is grit or gravel. And so it is with a shellac record. 80% is stone material, basically, rotten stone. So that's a much harder material than the wax. And so you pull energy out of the spring for the gramophone, and when you drive the stylus, you amplify it. And that is why you can record a soft sound but still hear it fairly loud from an acoustical gramophone. Now, all these things we have to bear in mind, and all of these things make this field actually a very, very technical one. And historians who come from the arts may have difficulties in handling these things unless they ally themselves with people with technical insights. The reason I can safely say that it's technical is that there are so many patents on it, and you only get patents for technical things. So it requires a sort of engineering insight to work with these things. If, on the other hand, an engineer wants to work with in historical detail, the best tool he can use is a timeline. And I made a timeline for some of what happened. At the same time, I'm going into the field that was treated by Fabrizio and Paul when they discussed Augustus Stroh's development and his contribution. And these are all dates on which we know something happened. Charles Crow, 18 April 1877, his conception. Edison, Ray Wiles' 1977 paper in Edinburgh said 17 July as his reduction to practice, and I like that. Some people have tried to move it to August, but I'm not convinced. And then we have the whole thing about how to demonstrate the phonograph in London, and what is really a very, very fundamental, important paper, Preece and Stroh's paper, presentation before the Royal Society in 1879. By then they had done quite a lot of work. I have made an extract that is much more readable than that, just taking the center part of it, and we can see that. Here we are. That's much better. Now, if we read the paper by Fabrizio and Paul, we see that he says that in January, Preece heard about the phonograph, and he instantly made Stroh prepare one for his demonstrations. After Preece heard about it in the article in the Times, which was based on a report from Edmonds, who was an engineer who had traveled to America. But Preece had been in correspondence with Edison for a long time, because Preece was a telegraph and telephone man and was very interested in Edison's experiments. And so already in December 1877, a month previously, he writes Edison and says, please supply a phonograph for my demonstration at the Royal Institution, which was to take place the 1st of February. And there is correspondence then. That is something that Edison couldn't make. And in one of his letters, he says, well, I promise and the promise, and I'm sorry if I give the impression that I never fulfill, but I'm now sending you a phonograph. But they had made one in between. Then, and there's correspondence here, on 11th February, Edison says to Preece, phonograph now is now run by clockwork. So Edison probably beat Stroh to a clockwork phonograph by a week or so. Then, on the 19th of February, we have a confirmation of the lead dispute that came out in the correspondence column concerning the paper on Stroh. Edison writes that he has embossed lead and iron, but iron wasn't very good. But then he writes a surprising thing. He has tried to take a coil and a core with a pointed end, and has made an electrical reproduction of his mechanical recording in iron. Now that is actually a bit earlier than what we have in the Iron Man who invented magnetic recording. What on earth is his name? Yes? Pardon? Yes. Oberlin Smith. But I mean, Edison does a lot of experiments. He describes them here and there, some of them in his notebook, but he doesn't follow through on these things. There is too much for him and his laboratory to follow through on. A great part of confusion comes in the paper, in the Stroh paper, by the date 7th of February, because that in 78, it was before the Society of Telegraph Engineers, and there was a demonstration of various models. But 1 year later, precisely to the date, it was at the Royal Society. In the whole paper, it's always referred to as being the Society of Telegraph Engineers, but there is no such paper. The confusion is old, in a way. In the obituary of Augustus Stroh, it is said by one who knew him that for one of the Friday night lectures at the I think I'll have to get the obituary to quote it properly. He gave at the Royal Institution one of the five Friday evening meetings on the 17th of February, 1879. But if you look at that date, the calendar for 1879, you find that the 17th of February is a Monday. So when was it taking place? And is he actually thinking of the 27th of February, which was the Royal Society, which is a completely different institution. So a lot of information of what went on these first years is extremely confusing, and you have to keep extremely good track of your sources and what they say. The fundamental thing about the Fabrizio and Paul paper is that they believe that in a demonstration that was made on the 27th of February, 1879, where they used a machine. Like this. This was Preece and Stroh using that machine. That some of these little discs should contain a recording of the human voice, and it does not. I have read through the paper with a fine-tooth comb, using my skills as a patent attorney, and try to see it from the side of, attorneys will always take a side. They will help, they are never neutral. So I try to see it from the side of those that are proponents of whether the disc could contain a live recorded sound. It cannot. There is no word in it that says so. I have a few handouts of an analysis I've made of the paper for the in front of the Royal Society that you can have. It's up here. And it goes through it paragraph by paragraph and will demonstrate that this is a nice thought and it would have been nice, but it is not a recording of the human voice. It's a simulation of the human voice. That machine represents one of the first synthesizers that we have. It represents the first recorded signal from a synthesizer. Helmholtz did synthesizers like that early on. He made them, used electromagnetic forks, electromagnetic driven forks that could be combined into cords. That was a synthesizer, actually with an electrical output, but he didn't use that, but he could have done that. But this is the first recorded electrical synthesizer. So this is very respectable, but it is not a sound recording in the sense that we say it has been a live recording. Yes? The diameter is such that there's room for 30... I haven't calculated it, but it's not big. It's probably no more than an inch or so. There are 30 vibrations corresponding to 200 hertz around the circumference. That is. So from that, those measurements are given in the article, and so from that we can calculate quite a lot. There are some that say ma-ma and some others that say pa-pa, but actually you only need to, the ma. You just need two revolutions for it, ma, ma, and pa, pa, you see. So it's not an indication that there was an actual mother and father present, not at all.
Right.
Incidentally, I think I'll show you what this sort of this is what you can get if you are among the 31st lucky persons. That is the analysis of what the paper, the original paper says. Actually, that sort of write-up you really should use for any document that you work with. If one makes a transcription of Edison's documents, his handwriting is legible, but it's easier to work from a written out version. Then you should also comment it in the same way, and using some of the principles that we've been through, in order to be able to oversee the field. Otherwise, you'll get bogged down in details and you won't get an overview. Getting back to the boxes, the chain, it is practical if you, in your mind, say, now I'm dealing with a transducer problem at this place in the chain, now I'm dealing with a transducer problem in that part in the chain. For instance, if we read the paper by Preece and Stroh, he talks about disks, but he uses the word disk for the physical entity, a circular disk of something, and some of the disks are the membranes or diaphragms, and some other disks are the recorded disks or the engraved disks, which have diameter variations corresponding to vibrations. So it is a very interesting work, but it is not easy. Right, I think if there is time for questions, I will definitely take some. Yes? Yes.
This way and this way. It's not, yes, two vertical modulations. And if you make a 45-45 stereophonic recording,
mm-hmm,
and that system was invented by Alan Blumlein in the late 1920s,
yes,
if you make a 45-45 stereophonic recording with pure coincident miking, cross figure eights as invented by Blumlein,
mm-hmm,
there will be no vertical modulation on the recording because the stereophonic information consists entirely of amplitude differences, not phase differences. The only way you can get a pure vertical modulation up and down on a stereophonic record is if there are severe phase differences between the two stereo channels. In other words, if the two channels have information that's 180 degrees out of phase, with blow light miking, you will never get that because it's only amplitude differences that make up the stereophonic image.
No, you're not right. I like your idea, and Blumlein, for one, was also a systems thinker. But if you take a pickup which is only sensitive to vertical modulation and you play a Blumlein record, then you will get a signal. There will be a vertical signal. It may not have relevance without being matrixed so as to get it together with the horizontal system and get a signal out, but there will be a signal.
There will be a signal.
Yes. No, 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 no. But what I'm saying is, if you look at the cutter head for a stereo, depending on the construction, the cutter head is vertical in principle because it goes into and out of the surface at 45 degrees. Never mind, but it's a vertical. It is that movement which is just moved. It's not a sideways movement which is just moved. And No. It's the movement. The movement. Vertical is not now anymore absolute. What I would say is that it is a movement that, with respect to the housing of the cutter head, goes in and out. That is what I mean by vertical. And you have one going in and out here, and one moving going in and out here, and that is the stereo. But they are in and out. They are not sideways. That is the difference. A horizontal recording in the same language would be one which moves parallel to the housing, part of the housing, and parallel part to the house. But they are really two. Vertical is it's a misnomer, because vertical usually refers to absolute vertical. Yes, so I think we agree, but we use the rank. I may use it wrongly by saying vertical for that. What I meant is a modulation in and out of the housing.
Well, that's true. I don't disagree.
No. All right, that's what I meant. Yes, back there. Yes.
He did, in fact, put one channel for horizontal modulation.
Yes.
And the other yes. channel as vertical modulation.
Yes.
But as Gary says, he used coincident microphone techniques, so there was actually no phase difference between the channels.
No. Yes. Yes. Well, they were completely independent. The funny thing is that Keller didn't know anything about Blumlein's work. But Blumlein, for practical purposes, because he used equipment that he had to hand and converted it slightly, worked on the horizontal vertical modulation principle in practice. But his patent also has the 45-45. But that's because he was a good systematic thinker. And he said, now I want to make a patent that covers all kinds of methods for making a stereoscopic, a stereophonic signal in a record. And that is why I'm also thinking about that. And I'll tell my patent attorney to write the claims so that it also comprises that sort of thing. And he also made a drawing. So Blumlein was the one who thought the systems through for the first time. Keller independently developed parts of it, but they never co-worked on anything, and they didn't know about each other's work. That I think, is a historical fact. But they are both great taking each. I mean, being the second one to invent something is just the same. If you don't know about the other thing, it's the same intellectual effort as being the first one. So it's just a matter of timing. Edison and Graham Bell also had only a few hours of difference of filing the patent application. That is the time when they still timestamped them on arrival. So conception and reduction to practice is something that can happen entirely independently. Yes, Mike? Just to round it off, I wanted to show, this is a Swiss physicist who in 1892 developed electrical recording and electrical reproduction of cylinders. And he did that in order to help the hard of hearing to hear the weak sounds from a phonograph. That it's not known in this part of the world. You have to go to Geneva and know that they are proud of their citizen, or he died in 1953, but he invented that as early as that, and it had no trace at all upon anybody until it was picked up, electrical recording was picked up in late teens and started around 1920 and then, of course, matured. So it's just, you have to bear in mind that you will come across surprising facts. You need to analyze them, you need to put them into perspective, but you must never blame anybody, because there can be no blame attached to being number two or number three. You can't know everything, but when you come across similar problems, you make similar solutions if you are similarly engineering-wise trained. And I think that is my conclusion.
Well, Edison's first patent includes telephonic recording as one of the possibilities.
Yes.
And so whether he did it or not, I think it's I'm not sure if we
I haven't seen it, but it can have happened. Yes.
It was,
yes.
One of the purposes of the phonograph would be telephonic, which would,
yes,
by definition, mean electrical.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just sit down here. I'm going to give you a form.
Very much, George. I think Bill is a first-time attending, or have you been here? He didn't get your blue dot, anyway. Blue dot for the man here in the corner. Yeah. Bill Walker is with the imaging is.